pulsing through the trees, and a lone hawk soared overhead, its shadow gliding briefly over the trail. The air was cool, smelling of sap and pine needles, and except for the hum of insects, everything was quiet. But I could sense something wasn't right, like a dark spot in the corner of my vision, keeping just out of reach. It had been 3 days since the girl and I had fled the mountain, away from the destruction of the Silent Wind's temple and the Amanjaku in the forest. Not much was said during our travels. The girl had been quiet and withdrawn, and I had no desire to engage her in conversation. It was early summer, the days hot and humid, the skies threatening rain at a moment's notice. We passed villages with thatched huts and terraced fields, where farmers shoved green rice seedlings into calf-deep water. When darkness fell, we slept beneath the trees or in abandoned shrines, the nights warm enough for us to be comfortable without blankets, which was fortunate as all my possessions had been lost when my horse fled, including my travel documents, most of my shinobi gear, and my rations for the journey. Thankfully, late summer in Iwagoto meant there were plenty of places to get food in the wild, if you knew where to look. Mushrooms, berries, and all manner of sansai, wild plants, were everywhere, and the rivers and streams yielded fish if one knew how to catch them without a line. I'd been trained to live off the land and survive in the wilderness, so we were in no danger of starving, though I was surprised to find the girl knew a fair bit about wild plants as well. One evening, as I was cleaning the fish I'd caught from the nearby stream, she appeared and dumped an armful of wild persimmons on the ground near the fire. I didn't care much for sweet things, but the ripe orange fruit contrasted with the blandness of the fish and filled our stomachs well that night. Throughout our travels, I hadn't felt the presence of demons, though Hakaimono had been unusually restless, either sensing invisible eyes on us or reacting to our unexpected companion. I had been alone for so long that having another human constantly present was distracting for both myself and the sword. I ignored the girl as much as possible, trying not to see the tears that sometimes leaked from her eyes or hear the faint gasps and sniffles when she was curled up asleep. This morning, however, she had greeted me with a smile and a cheerful, "Ohayou gozaimasu, Tatsumi-san," seeming to abandon her dark mood. We'd continued down the road, but this afternoon I couldn't shake the feeling of being watched. It had continued to plague me, irritating Hakaimono to no end, until I'd finally halted and searched the trees for our unknown stalker. I was giving away the knowledge that I knew something was out there, but at this moment, I would rather face something that I could fight and kill instead of worrying about a nameless threat I couldn't see. My gaze stopped as I finally pinpointed the source of my unease. In the limbs of a pine tree that stretched over the road, a small, hunched figure gazed down at us, unblinking. Crows again. I narrowed my eyes, glaring at the bird, which ruffled its feathers but didn't move from the branch. Crows were everywhere in Iwagoto, from one end of the country to the other. Murders of them clustered on rooftops or in tree branches, fighting for space, their guttural caws scolding as you passed beneath. Sometimes they were seen as ill omens, bringers of misfortune, but for the most part, they were a common, everyday sight, and no one gave the squabbling creatures a second glance. But every once in a while, especially when I was traveling, a single crow would appear, dogging me, watching me. Killing the bird did nothing. Another would appear soon after, as if to taunt my efforts. Or worse, it would stay just out of sight, irritating Hakaimono until it was ready to lash out at anything that moved. At least now I knew the cause of the uneasiness, and would be ready if my unknown stalker decided to attack.
Tatsumi-san?
I turned back to find the girl watching me, her head cocked slightly. She hadn't noticed the bird in the tree, and I didn't feel like explaining, especially since neither of us could do anything about it.
It's nothing, I told her, continuing down the trail again. Let's keep moving.
She nodded, falling into step beside me. I could see her in the corner of my vision, dark hair rippling in the breeze, her gaze on the forest around us. Unlike the past 2 days, when she'd followed silently at my back, staring dully at the ground. The furoshiki cloth was wrapped around her shoulders. She hadn't taken it off once, and every night made sure it was secured tightly to her person. I imagined it contained the last of her meager belongings, and that perhaps she was afraid I would steal them, though I had no interest in the possessions of a peasant girl.
Ne, Tatsumi-san, she said,
looking up from where she had been watching a squirrel on a branch. She did that a lot, I noticed, seemingly fascinated by the smallest things. Like a cat, constantly distracted by flitting shadows.
We haven't found anything to eat today. What are we going to do for food?
Chochinmachi is a few miles from here, I replied. We'll resupply when we reach the town. She nodded again.
It'll be nice to eat real food again, she commented. Not that I have anything against wild-caught fish and persimmons, but I'm starting to crave a hot rice bowl and a real bed, where I don't wake up with spiders in my clothes. Not that I mind the spiders, but I don't want to crush them when I roll about.
She cast me a sideways glance.
What about you, Tatsumi-san?
I shrugged. I had gone days without eating or sleeping, both in the field and in training with my sensei. Sometimes as a punishment, but mainly it was to test my endurance, to see how far I could go before I collapsed. I had been trained to survive on very little. Food, sleep, and personal comfort were not as important as completing the mission. The girl let out a long breath and gazed up at the sky, at the sun sinking slowly below the tree line.
Back at the temple, we'd be gathering for the evening meal right now, she continued softly. We didn't have a lot, but we ate together 3 times a day. Satoshi had a little vegetable garden in the back. He could grow the biggest daikon radishes you'd ever seen.
Her nose wrinkled.
I hated daikon, and we had so much of it. I'd drop pieces through cracks in the temple floor, and then have nightmares of pickled radish monsters hiding under my floorboards, crawling up to force themselves into my mouth as I slept.
She paused, her next words even softer.
I would eat a dozen radishes right now, if it meant I could sit down with everybody one more time.
I had no answer for that. So I said nothing. She was quiet, and I felt her gaze on me again.
Do you have any family, Tatsumi?
No.
But you're a samurai.
She cocked her head.
You carry a sword, and you have the mon crest of House Kage on your back, so that means you must be part of the Shadow Clan, yes?
I narrowed my eyes. All the great houses had their own mon crests that showed their lineage and to which family they belonged, but in my experience, none of the peasant folk cared enough to tell them apart. To them, all samurai were the same.
How do you know that? I asked her.
Yumeko blinked.
Master Isao taught me about the different clans and houses, she explained. He wanted me to know a little of the outside world, in case I ever left the temple. Let's see if I can remember them all.
Her brow furrowed.
The Hino, Mizu, Tsuchi, and Kaze are the 4 great families of fire, water, earth, and wind, she recited, while the Kage, Sora, and Tsuki are the minor clans, the shadow, sky, and moon. Is that correct?
You forgot one.
Oh, right, Yumiko nodded. The Sun Clan is the imperial family, the Taiyo. But most of them stay in the capital, close to the emperor. They almost never leave their territories unless they're visiting the daimyos of the other clans. Or so Master Isao told me.
I regarded her seriously. What do you know about the Kage?
That they're the smallest of the minor families. Their territory borders the Fire Clans, and they've lost several battles with the Hino, who have been pushing into their lands over the past decade.
All true. The Fire Clan was the ancient enemy of the Kage. Even in times of peace, when the Emperor ordered a countrywide truce, the Hino and the Kage were constantly at each other's throats. The Fire Clan was large and influential, and thought that if a clan wasn't strong enough to defend their territory, it should be taken by someone who could. Naturally, the Kage disagreed. But that was common knowledge. Two clans feuding over territory was as ordinary as rain during the wet season, with borders changing so often that even the magistrates were hard-pressed to keep up.
What else? I asked softly.
Well, it's said that the Kage aren't like other clan samurai, that their warriors use darkness and questionable techniques to their advantage when fighting superior forces, that they can melt into shadows or disappear in a cloud of smoke, and that their daimyo is a mysterious lady who is rumored to be immortal.
I relaxed. Those were all common rumors, some of them true, but encouraged by the Shadow Clan to keep our foes guessing and off balance. She hadn't heard anything that the Kage did not approve of, which was good, because the true secrets of the Shadow Clan were not supposed to be known to outsiders. Those who discovered too much were usually silenced, quickly and permanently. Hakaemono approved of this idea, urging me to strike now, to cut her down.
You don't need her, the demon seemed to whisper in my head. One quick blow, and it will be over.
There would be no pain. She wouldn't even realize what had happened until she woke up with her ancestors. I pushed those thoughts away. I had no orders to kill the girl, nor did I believe that she was a threat to the Shadow Clan. Besides, I had promised to accompany her to the Steel Feather Temple, and I needed her help to find the scroll. Unless the clan told me otherwise, that was my first and only priority. The shadows of the forest were growing long. I could still feel the crow's eyes on me, but could no longer see it in the branches around us. As the sun dipped lower in the sky, blips of light began to wink in and out of existence, as fireflies drifted through the wood and floated through the air.
Ne, Tatsumi?
Yumiko asked, holding up a hand so that a firefly perched on her finger, winking green and gold in the twilight. Bringing it close to her face, she watched it curiously, casting her skin in an eerie glow.
The sun is starting to set, she said,
unaware as I paused to gaze at her.
Are we very close to Chochinmachi?
Yes. She raised her arm, and the insect spiraled off into the forest.
Why is it called Lantern Town?
We came out of the trees, and the road sloped gently away down a hill toward a river and a series of docks on the other side. See for yourself. Gazing down the rise, she drew in a slow breath. Chochinmachi sat on the banks of the Hotaru River, glowing like a torch against the night. It wasn't a large town like Kinhegan Toshi, the capital city. It boasted a small castle, a handful of inns, shops, and restaurants, and a fishing industry that did a fair job of supporting the town. Though that wasn't why Chochinmachi was famous, or why it drew pilgrims and travelers from around Iwagoto.
On nearly every street, every corner and business and shrine, hundreds of red paper lanterns cast their soft glow into the darkness, lighting up the town. They hung from rooftops and tree branches, from doorways and awnings, and from the helm of every ship floating on the river. The glow of the town could be seen for miles in every direction, and travelers flocked to it like moths to a flame.
"Sugoi," Yumiko whispered. "Amazing."
Her eyes were round pools of black, and the lights of the town flickered in their depths.
"It's beautiful. The monks never told me there was anything like this beyond the temple."
She paused, then cocked her head, as if listening for something on the wind.
"Are those drums?"
I stifled a groan. Late summer in Iwagoto was festival season, which meant Chochinmachi would be especially crowded tonight. "Stay close," I told the girl. "It's not a big town, but we don't want to be separated." I turned away and started walking down the rise, hearing her hurry after me. We crossed the arched bridge over the river, where lanterns flickered atop the posts every few feet, and stepped into the ethereal glow of Chochinmachi. Yumiko's eyes remained wide as we walked down the broad, dusty street that cut through the market district. Unlike many towns that closed their doors when the sun went down, Chochinmachi's shops thrived after dark. Strings of lanterns swung overhead, sometimes blocking out the sky, while individual chochin flickered in the doorways of shops, inns, and restaurants, indicating that they were open. Market stalls sold their wares in the streets, everything from food to sandals to miniature paper lanterns, popular souvenirs of Chochinmachi. As we neared the center of town, the sound of drums, deep and booming, began echoing into the night once more. Trailing the crowd, we came upon a large open square, where a tall wooden platform draped in red and white stood in the center like a beacon. Atop the stage, two bare-chested men with strips of red cloth tied around their foreheads beat a pair of large wooden drums with sticks, sending thunderous notes reverberating through the crowd. Strings of lanterns hung overhead, converging on the platform roof and lighting up the square, while people danced in a circle around the drummers, clapping and stamping their feet to the music. I bristled, and in my head, Hakaemono stirred, riled by all the noise and movement. I did not like crowds. Too many things could happen. Emotions could surge out of control. Fights could break out. People could panic. If the gathering here became a riot and Hakaemono took control, this festival would swiftly turn into a bloodbath. I walked a little faster, hoping to get away from the lights and music and into the darkness where I was comfortable. Preoccupied with watching the crowd, I suddenly realized Yumiko was no longer beside me. Turning, I saw her at the edge of the square, gazing at the circle of dancers, bobbing in place as she did. With a scowl, I doubled back and moved beside her, leaning close to be heard over the drums.
"Yumiko, what are you doing?"
"Tatsumi-san!"
She glanced at me, eyes bright, apparently unable to keep her body still.
"Dance with me!"
she implored, gesturing to the singing, stamping mob.
"Teach me how!"
I recoiled. Dance was not part of my training, being seen as frivolous and impractical by my sensei. I could appreciate the art and the skill required to play an instrument, but I knew nothing of dancing and had no desire to learn. "No."
"Please, Tatsumi-san?"
She took a step back toward the edge of the circle. The boom of the drums rose into the air, punctuated by the claps of the crowd, and she smiled at me.
"Just for a little while. It'll be fun."
Fun. I stifled a wince. Fun was a dangerous word among my sensei.
"Are we having fun yet, Tatsumi?"
Ichiro-san had often crooned, usually when I was struggling with a given task, and right before I was punished for my failure.
"Since you're having so much fun, we'll try the same thing tomorrow."
"We don't have time for this," I said. She wrinkled her nose, then sighed.
"Tatsumi-san, have you ever heard the proverb of the Kawauso River Otter and the Jade Prophet?"
she asked.
"In this tale," she went on before I could answer, "there was a Kawauso who took nothing seriously, who turned everything into a game and brought joy and frivolity wherever he went. In his wake, people laughed, danced, sang, and forgot about their troubles. But one day, the Kawauso met the Jade Prophet, who told him, 'Life is suffering. Fun is a fleeting waste of time. You must stop these foolish games and strive to work hard without fail. Only in suffering, dullness, and boredom can you find true happiness.' The Kawauso took her advice to heart. He stopped all his games, worked himself to death, and died a bitter old yokai with no friends, no family, and no joy in his life."
"I have never heard that proverb," I said dubiously. Yumiko grinned.
"Of course not. It doesn't exist."
And before I could stop her, she took three steps back and melted into the crowd of dancers. I stared after her, fisting my hands at my side, as the girl joined the rippling throng. Overhead, the drums boomed, the crowd sang, and Yumiko danced, swaying her body and clapping her hands to the music. Watching her, I found myself holding my breath, unable to look away. For just a moment, with her dark hair rippling about and her skin glowing under the lantern light, she was mesmerizing. With a mental shake, I stalked along the edge of the square, keeping an eye on the girl as well as the people around her. "Foolish," all my instincts told me. "This is foolish. A waste of time." It had nothing to do with the mission, nor did it bring us any closer to our objective.
"Do not let her distract you. She is important to the mission, nothing more."
As I circled after the girl, there was a flutter of something in the corner of my eye, like an enormous moth or bat. My hand shot up, snatching it from the air just before it hit the side of my head. Fragile, papery wings crumpled in my grip. I lowered my arm and opened my fingers to reveal a folded origami crane, the paper pitch black and without design, lying crushed in the center of my palm. Apprehension flickered.
"A summons? Now?"
Warily, I scanned the crowds, searching for hidden threats, for faces that I knew and gazes that lingered too long on me. I spotted nothing out of place, but a ripple of unease crept up my spine. Not for me, but for the girl dancing in the crowd.
"What should I do? I can't take her with me. They'll kill her."
I glanced around, wondering if I could slip away and leave Yumiko here. If she'd be in the same place when I returned. But that was risky. I needed the girl to take me to the Steel Feather Temple, and Yumiko seemed the type to wander after me if I simply disappeared. If she stumbled upon Shadow Clan business, they would show her no mercy. Gazing around, I spotted a large square building on the corner of the street, blue curtains over the door, welcoming in travelers. A ryokan.
"That will have to do."
I stalked around the circle, found Yumiko in the sea of dancers, and grabbed her by the arm. She jumped, gazing at me with large black eyes, and I felt an odd churning sensation in my stomach.
"Oh, Tatsumi-san!"
She blinked, then gave me a somewhat wry smile.
"Did you change your mind?
Were you so moved by the proverb of the Kawauso and the Jade Prophet that you decided to give fun a try?"
I glared at her. "That wasn't even a real proverb."
"But it can still teach a valuable lesson. You don't want to become a mean old river otter, do you?"
Setting my jaw, I pulled her to the edge of the square, then nodded to the end of the street. "Do you see the building on the corner?" I asked in a furtive voice. "The one with the largest lantern and the blue curtains over the doorway?" She gazed over the heads of the crowd.
"The ryokan?"
So, she knew what an inn was, at least. Good. "Take these," I said, and dropped a trio of silver tora into her open palm. The coins clinked against each other. 3 silver discs with the imprint of a snarling tiger in the center. "Go to the inn. Use the money to get us a room for the night. That should cover everything." She gazed at the money in her hands, then back up at me.
"Where are you going?"
"I have business to take care of. I won't be long."
"Business?" Her brow furrowed. "At this time of night?"
When I didn't answer, the frown deepened.
"Why can't we go together?"
"That is not possible."
"Why not?"
Irritation flared, mingled with a hint of fear. "You ask a lot of questions," I told her in a cold voice. Questions were dangerous. Questions would get her killed faster than anything else. "Perhaps there are things you don't need to know." She shrank back, then sighed and closed her fingers tightly around the coins.
"Just promise you'll come back," she said quietly. "That you won't disappear into the night and I'll never see you again? Swear to me that you'll come back."
"I have no intention of leaving."
"Do you promise?"
"Yes." She nodded once and stepped away, but I abruptly reached out and caught her sleeve, making her turn. "I want the same promise," I told her, and a flicker of confusion crossed her face. "That you'll remain at the inn. That you won't try to leave or follow me. Stay in the room until I return, Yumeko. Promise me." She nodded.
"I will."
"Go then." I released her, and she started across the street toward the ryokan, clutching the handful of coins. I watched until she had ducked through the doorway beneath the curtains, then turned and walked back the way we'd come. Something rustled in my hand. When I opened the fist, the folded paper crane stirred and unfurled crumpled black wings. With several flaps, the paper creature rose into the air like a dying butterfly and flitted away. I followed. The crane led me past the square, the drums still pounding out their booming rhythm, to a narrow alley between a tea house and a textile shop. The origami creature continued into the corridor, flitting over the ground, but I paused at the entrance and gazed into the dark. Overhead, a single string of chōching stretched away for a good 50 feet, illuminating the wooden walls on either side before ending at an intersection. Wary of attacks and threats hidden in the shadows, I stepped into the alley. Directly above me, a lantern flickered once and went out. The next one followed, going dark as its flame was extinguished, as did the next and the next. One by one, all the chōching on the string down the alley sputtered and went out, plunging the narrow space into complete darkness. I kept walking. Darkness was no cause for alarm. I was more comfortable in the shadows than the light. I followed the dying lanterns until I reached the intersection and stopped, gazing down one road, then the other. They stretched away between buildings, cutting a narrow path behind stores and warehouses, completely empty and dark.
"Hello, Tatsumi."
The soft, high voice echoed behind me, and even though I recognized it, I stifled the urge to spin and draw my sword, forcing myself to turn calmly. A figure sat in the back doorway of a storehouse, cloaked in shadow, where nothing had been before. His robes, black and unmarked, billowed around him, and his long hair fell loose down his shoulders and back. His face was painted white, with heavy lines of black around his eyes and down his chin. He wore a single short sword at his waist, but his skills were not of the blade, though they were just as deadly. He was Kami touched. what ordinary people would call a majutsushi, or magic user. All the clans had a few unique individuals whose talents reflected their family's element, but the majutsushi were by far the strongest and most powerful. As a kage shinobi, I could work small shadow magics, become invisible, or create a ghostly twin, the talents of darkness and misdirection. But within Iwagoto, there were majutsushi that could turn the very land against you, call down fire or lightning, or heal a fatal wound in a few heartbeats. The mages of the kage were not as destructively impressive as the fire clan or miracle workers like the water clan. Their command of the night and everything in it was subtle, though no less dangerous. "Jomei-san," I said, and bowed, feeling his gaze follow my every move. "So it's your turn to check up on me, I see."
"That's not a very nice greeting, Tatsumi-san,"
Jomei said in his high, breathy voice.
"If I was the type, I might be offended. You know why we must do this."
"I know."
"Kamigoroshi is not something we take lightly,"
Jomei went on as if I hadn't spoken.
"We of the Shadow Clan know darkness better than most. We dance with it every day and walk a very thin line between the shadows and the abyss. We know the evil that lurks in the hidden places of Iwagoto and in the souls of men. And we know, more than any other clan, how easy it is to fall. You are the bearer of the cursed blade," Jomei went on. "Kamigoroshi, Hakaimono, whatever you wish to call it. That sword has corrupted the souls of better men than you, Kage Tatsumi. We have taught you how to resist its influence, trained you in the ways of the Kage Shinobi, and yet we know the terrible evil you carry, that one day you might succumb to the darkness." His eyes narrowed. "Which is why we follow you, why these meetings are essential. If there is any hint that you are losing the battle with Hakaimono, we must take care of it immediately, before you lose yourself and the true demon is released."
I bowed my head. He was right, of course. What had come over me? I had never spoken to the majutsushi like that. Perhaps Yumiko's peasant mannerisms were affecting my judgment. "Forgive my outburst, Master Jomei," I said. "It won't happen again."
"Good. Now,"
Jomei settled back, lacing his fingers under his chin as he watched me.
"Since you seem to have a handle on Kamigoroshi, what of your mission? Did you reach the Silent Winds Temple? Were you able to retrieve the scroll?"
"No," I straightened, stifling all emotion. I was a weapon. I felt nothing. "It was gone when I got there."
"Gone?"
Jomei's gaze sharpened.
"What do you mean, gone? Are you saying that the mission was a failure?"
"An army of Amanjaku attacked the temple. They were led by an oni." Jomei's brows arched. Demons were something the Shadow Clan took very seriously. "The master of the temple sensed them coming," I went on, "and sent the scroll away before they could reach it."
"An oni?"
The other kage's voice was grave.
"Merciful Kami, who is summoning oni into this realm? Did you kill it?"
"No." His lips thinned.
"Tatsumi-san, I understand that you have been taught to answer only what is asked of you, but I am going to need a little more information than that. Please give me the full report of your mission and all the important details. Leave nothing out."
"As you wish."
and I proceeded to tell him what had happened that night, everything from fighting the Amanjaku to meeting Yumeko and agreeing to accompanying her to King Heigen Toshi. I told him of the plan to find Master Jiro at the Hayate Shrine in the hopes that he could show us the way to the Steel Feather Temple and the scroll that had eluded me.
I see,
Jomei said when I was done. He stapled two fingers together and tapped them against his lips.
The Steel Feather Temple has been lost to legend, he murmured. There are tales that it is protected by supernatural guardians, but no one knows where it is for certain, if it even exists.
His gaze flicked to me again, hard and appraising.
Are you certain that accompanying the girl is the only way you can reach this Master Jiro?
I know the name of the shrine, I replied. I could find it on my own. But the priest would have no cause to reveal what he knows to me. The girl was part of the Silent Winds Temple, part of the order that protected the scroll. He will talk to her, and if she can show me the way to my objective, I would do better to follow.
Jomei sighed. Very well, he nodded. Continue to travel with her for now. If this Master Jiro knows the location of the Steel Feather Temple and the scroll, you must find it at all costs. But be careful. The girl must not discover anything she has not already heard about the Shadow Clan. As soon as you are in possession of the scroll, return to Lady Hunsho.
I bowed. I understand.
I must inform Hunsho some of this.
Jomei murmured. Demons would have no use for the scroll. Someone is sending them. He rose gracefully, robes falling around him, and gave me a faint smile.
We'll be watching you, Tatsumi-san. Don't disappoint us.
I bowed once more, and when I rose, Jomei was gone. The lanterns flickered, then sputtered to life one by one, illuminating the empty alley. I retraced my steps to the main road and made my way back to the inn where I had sent Yumeko. I ducked beneath the curtain over the door, then straightened and gazed around the entrance. A raised wooden floor sat a few steps away, with a couple benches placed along the walls to accommodate travelers. Across the room, a staircase ascended to the top floor where I assumed the guest accommodations were located. A woman, probably the hostess, hurried toward me, smiling and then dropping into a bow at the edge of the raised floor.
"Welcome, sir," she announced. "Please, come in. Will you be needing a room for the night?"
"Yes," I said. "But there was a girl here earlier, in a red kimono with a white sash. She should have gotten us a room."
"Oh?"
The hostess frowned slightly, glancing at the door.
"She was your companion, was she?" "Well, she's not here anymore."
I narrowed my eyes. "What happened? Where is she?"
"There was a girl like that here,"
the hostess continued, sounding nervous now.
"Just a few minutes ago, in fact. A cute little thing in a red kimono. But then a wind blew in out of nowhere. It was so strong it nearly knocked me down. And when I looked up, the girl was gone."
11. Weasels on the Wind. It began with a strange wind. I'd meant to get a room, I really had, and food, and maybe a bath. But especially food. I was starving, and the idea of sitting in a clean room eating a hot meal instead of in the wilderness chewing on wild plants sounded wonderful. Even though I was extremely curious about where Tatsumi was running off to, following him, especially when I had the dragon's scroll hidden in my furoshiki, seemed like a bad idea. Besides, he'd promised me he would return. I had to trust he would keep his word and come back. But then, as I stepped over the threshold, a vicious blast of wind tossed my hair and caused me to stumble forward. The wind swirled through the doorway, ripping at the curtains and extinguishing the lanterns inside and out, plunging the room into shadow. As I straightened, a lock of my hair suddenly fell to the floor, sliced clean through, as if by a very sharp blade. My eyes widened, and a flutter of alarm went through me. I looked up to see a pair of beady red eyes watching me from atop one of the lanterns on the ceiling. They were attached to a furry brown creature with a pointed muzzle, small rounded ears, and a long, sinewy body. A weasel? I frowned. An ordinary-looking weasel, except... My mouth fell open, except for the long, sickle-shaped blades growing right out of its forelegs. Curved and deadly-looking, they extended behind the creature's elbows and glimmered in the darkness of the room. Not a normal weasel at all, I realized. A creature that possessed magic or other supernatural powers. A yokai. Like me. The weasel thing hissed, bearing sharp yellow fangs, leaped off the statue, and disappeared. Another wind sliced through the ryokan, flapping the curtains, making me wince and stumble back. As I regained my balance, I felt a stinging sensation against my cheek and put a hand to my face. My fingers came away smeared with blood. Heart pounding, I looked through the doorway. The weasel thing was perched on the roof of a wooden vendor stall across the street, still watching me with eyes like embers in the shadows. I dropped my hand from the shallow cut across my cheek. It wants me to follow it. The other people in the room hadn't noticed the intruder. They were still straightening up, recovering from being nearly knocked down twice by the mysterious wind. If I didn't leave, the weasel thing might keep coming back and slashing at others with those wickedly curved blades. Besides, I was curious, intrigued by the presence of another yokai, and a full-blooded one at that. It might be common to see them in the woods or mountains, but they tended to avoid large towns and places with lots of people. If the weasel yokai had shown himself to me here, it was for a reason. Wiping my cheek with the back of my sleeve, I left the inn and hurried back into the streets of Chochinmachi. The yokai flowed with the wind, flitting from place to place, invisible when it was on the move, reappearing when it was stationary. I followed it down the main street, watching as it flew from rooftop to rooftop, making the lanterns sway wildly in its wake. People stumbled as it passed overhead, holding onto their robes and parasols as the wind gusted by. "What strange weather," someone muttered as I passed. I wasn't aware that Chochinmachi was so windy. I followed the creature down a narrow alley, watching the lanterns overhead dance and bounce until it turned a corner and we came to a dead end. With a blast of wind, the weasel thing twisted into the air and vanished. I waited, but neither the wind nor the yokai reappeared. The air was still and silent, and the passage was empty. I frowned. So that weasel thing just wanted to trick me. And now I'm lost. I gazed around, wondering if I could retrace my steps back to the ryokan. Except I had no idea where I was. Denga-san would find this hilarious. A soft chuckle came from behind me, low and mocking. "Well, hello, little fox. Wandering lonely back alleys all by yourself?" I spun. A woman stood atop a roof, framed by the light of the moon. She was tall and slender, wearing an elegant kimono decorated with swirling white clouds against a sky-blue background. Her hair was long, unbound, and rippled like strands of ink in the wind. Billowy sleeves draped her arms, hanging nearly to her ankles, as she regarded me with pale, icy blue eyes. Hello, I greeted warily. Is this your alley? The woman didn't move, and I took a cautious step back. If she realized I was Kitsune, she probably wouldn't take kindly to a strange yokai in her territory. I'm just a little lost, so if you could just point me in the right direction. The woman's full lips curled as she looked me up and down. Vermin, she remarked, making me frown. A filthy and revolting vermin. Just like my Kamaitachi. She raised her arm, and the weasel thing appeared on it with a blast of wind that whipped at my hair and clothes. But at least they're full-blooded yokai, and somewhat useful. You're just a pathetic little half-fox, aren't you? I laced back my ears. Well, that's not very nice, I said, feeling Kitsune Bee spring to my fingertips. We've only just met. Besides, foxes are not vermin. I think you're mistaking me for a rat or cockroach. I took a few cautious steps back. But I seem to have caught you on a bad night, so I'll be leaving now. Oh, you're not going anywhere, vermin. She swept her arm out, and a blast of wind ripped at my clothes, making me stumble. At the same time, I felt a blinding pain in my leg, the feeling of being cut with a knife, though I saw nothing strike me. It happened so fast, I didn't even have time to yelp before my leg gave out and I collapsed to the ground. Gasping, I looked up to see a second weasel appear on the woman's other shoulder, beady eyes in its black masked face glaring down at me. The edge of the sickle growing from its foreleg was smeared with blood. My name is Mistress Kazekira, the woman said, as both weasels glared at me from her slender shoulders. I am one of the Kami-touched, what the common folk call a wind witch, and the Kamaitachi are my familiars. So don't think you can just run away, little vermin. She stroked one Kamaitachi's head, but there was no affection in the gesture, only possession, and the weasel yokai cringed away from her touch. The wind witch didn't seem to notice or care. And I see you are as simple-minded as you are common, she went on, wiping her hands together as if they were dirty. I didn't lure you out here to chat. I brought you here to kill you. Ice twisted my stomach. Why? I struggled to my feet, feeling my leg throb and pulse like it was on fire, and nearly collapsed again. My foxfire had sputtered out. I raised an arm and called it to life again, a blue-white globe flaring in my hand. It wouldn't hurt them, but maybe they didn't know that. I haven't done anything to you or your weasels. Why are you doing this? The Wind Witch laughed heartily, her hair writhing madly around her. Oh, little vermin, she chuckled, raising her arm. The two Kamaitachi crouched on her shoulders, blades gleaming as they targeted me. If you cannot figure that out, then you really are too stupid to keep living. So loud, sighed a new, unfamiliar voice behind me. At least you could have the courtesy to kill her quickly. Some of us are trying to sleep, after all. Startled, the Wind Witch lowered her arm, and I turned toward the voice. A body sat on one of the barrels close to the wall, cloaked in the shadows cast from the roof. Raising its head, it stood and walked into the light. My heartbeat fluttered, whether in awe or fear, I couldn't tell. A man stood before me, tall and slender, the moonlight casting a silvery halo around him. His billowing robes were a spotless white, trimmed in red and black, without patterns, markings, or a family crest to identify him. His hair was very fine, even longer than the Wind Witch's, and a bright, stunning silver, the color of a polished blade. An enormously long, curved sword was strapped to his back, the sheath dwarfing a katana's by several inches, the hilt doubled in length. Lazy, heavy-lidded eyes like molten gold met my gaze, then slid past me to the witch standing overhead.
"You're making an awful racket," the stranger said in that low, vaguely wry voice, as if he found this situation amusing. "It's fortunate humans are all deaf, or they would hear you for miles. Does it really take such elaboration to kill one little half-fox in an empty alley?"
"Seigetsu-sama," whispered the witch. Her face had gone pale, the wind dying to a murmur as she stared at him. "What are you doing here? Do you know this vermin?"
"The half-breed?"
The stranger's lips twisted in a smirk.
"No, I was just in the area and decided to take a nap." "By all means, continue."
He waved at me in an offhand manner and started walking away. My heart sank. I had thought the stranger was going to help me. He looked powerful with his golden eyes and giant sword. Even the wind witch seemed afraid of him. Kazekira smiled triumphantly and raised her arm, her clothes and hair beginning to snap in the wind once more.
"Although..."
The stranger stopped, rubbing his chin and glanced up at the witch again.
"They say Kamaitachi move so quickly the naked eye cannot comprehend them. I've always wondered if that was true."
Reaching back, he drew his weapon over his head, lacquered case and all. Holding the sheath in his left hand, he slid 1 foot back until he was in some sort of stance, his empty hand hovering a few inches from the hilt of the giant sword.
"Let's play a game,"
the stranger said, a vicious smile crossing his face as he stared at the witch.
"You send your familiars to kill this half-breed, and I try to cut them from the air before they can reach her. If the Kamaitachi are as fast as the stories claim, they should be in no danger. If not, well..."
He lifted one lean shoulder in a shrug.
"You can always find more, right?"
The wind witch stiffened. On her shoulders, the two Kamaitachi cowered, looking reluctant. My heart pounded as the silence stretched out. The beautiful stranger didn't move, his hand steady and motionless over the hilt of his sword, ready to draw steel in the blink of an eye. Finally, Kazekira raised her chin and sniffed. "Much as I would like to play your game, Seigetsu-sama," she said in a lofty voice, "I don't think I can convince my cowardly vermin weasels to cooperate, so you'll have to excuse us." With a sneer, she glanced in my direction. "Consider yourself lucky, half-breed. You get to live tonight. But Seigetsu-sama won't always be around to protect you. My Kamaitachi and I will see you soon." A strong wind gusted through the shrine, stirring dust and making the lantern sway. The wind witch rose into the air, robes billowing around her, and drifted away over the rooftops. In seconds, she had disappeared. As the wind died down, I looked at the stranger, watching as he straightened and slipped the weapon over his shoulders again. "Seigetsu-sama," the witch had called him, a suffix reserved for those of the highest station. Did that mean he was a lord? Perhaps the daimyo of one of the great clans? I wouldn't have thought that I would meet someone so important in the back alleys of Chochin-machi, but I didn't know much about the outside world. Perhaps he was taking an evening stroll around town, without the company of his samurai and bodyguards. It seemed unlikely, but whatever his reasons, I did know that his timing was impeccable. "Ano," I stammered as the stranger glanced up, those lazy golden eyes pinning me in place. For a moment, I felt almost naked beneath them, all my secrets laid bare.
Shaking myself, I offered a smile. Thank you. One corner of his mouth quirked.
You're welcome, he stated simply. And consider yourself lucky. I don't make a habit of saving oblivious half-foxes from angry Kamaitachi, but tonight I thought I would make an exception.
He regarded me with cool amusement.
You know why Kazekira was after you, yes?
How did he know about the scroll? Come to think of it, how did Kazekira? I swallowed hard, feeling the narrow case hidden in my furoshiki. I really have no idea. One silver brow arched.
You're going to have to lie better than that if you want to survive, half-breed, he told me. There are many out there searching desperately for the scroll who will do anything to acquire it.
I tensed, and he chuckled, shaking his head.
You can relax. I have no interest in the dragon's wish, or you. But I will offer this bit of advice. Don't tell the demon slayer about Kazekira.
My ears pricked. He knew about Tatsumi as well? Who was he? Why? His eyes, golden and mesmerizing, bore into mine.
Because, little fox, powerful kami-touched witches don't randomly attack ordinary peasant girls without reason, especially in a town or city. The demon slayer knows this. If you tell him you were assaulted by a wind witch with kami-touchy familiars, he's going to want to know why she was after you. And what will you tell him then?
Oh, I bit my lip. Good point. Shaking his head, the stranger started to walk away, but paused again, watching me from the corner of his eye.
You will likely see Kazekira again,
he warned.
If you do, and the demon slayer somehow gets himself into trouble, remember this.
He raised a hand, the last three fingers held up, long and elegant.
Kamaitachi always come in threes. Their loyalty to each other is unbreakable, and if one is threatened, the others will do whatever it takes to save their brother or sister. Remember that, and ask yourself why Kazekira has only two familiars. Sayonara.
Before I could reply, he strode down the alleyway and vanished into the darkness. Walking was painful. Gritting my teeth, I pushed myself along the wall of the alley, feeling the wound throb and pulse with every motion. Gingerly, I pulled up the hem of my robe, expecting to see a mess of blood smeared across my skin and dripping to the ground. I found the gash easily enough, a thin, straight cut right above my knee. But though it looked fairly deep, it wasn't bleeding. As I limped toward the main street, there was a blur of shadow, and the bright edge of a sword suddenly blocked my path. Freezing, I looked up into Tatsumi's cold, unamused face. I shrank from him as he pressed forward, his terrible blade casting his face in a faint glow as it hovered between us. Hitting the wall, I winced as the movement sent a flare of pain through my leg, making me gasp.
Itte!
I whimpered.
Ouch!
Instantly, the blade at my throat lowered a few inches, and Tatsumi frowned at me.
You're injured, he stated, his cold fury thawing a bit. What happened?
I was attacked, I stammered.
Remembering what Seigetsu had said, I thought quickly. I was going to get us a room at the inn, but then there was this strange wind, and something hit me. I ran, and it chased me here.
Where is it now?
It was invisible, I went on, making his eyes narrow. Or it was too fast. I didn't see anything when I was cut. But I did look up once, and there was this weasel thing with knives growing from its legs perched on the corner of a roof.
Kamaitachi? Here?
Tatsumi took a step back and scanned the alley, his gaze sweeping the rooftops. His sword flared, almost in excitement, but the shadows surrounding us were empty. Kamaitachi? I repeated, as if this were the first time I'd heard it. What are they? Sickle weasels, Tatsumi answered, not taking